This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guests today are Michael Stevens and Michael Casey, formerly the writers of the Transparent Library column in Library Journal. Michael Stevens is an assistant professor in the School of Library and Information Science at San Jose State University and is the writer of the Office Hours column in Library Journal. He also created the Tame the Web blog. Michael Casey is the Information Technology Director for Gwinnett County Public Library in Metro Atlanta and is the co-author of Library 2.0, A Guide to Participatory Library Service. Michael and Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hello.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
The first thing I wanted to talk about was sort of how did you guys meet? You guys had your column together. I know you guys are friends. You guys have worked together a lot. But I don't know how you all first met each other.
Michael, I think I'm right. I think it was September of 2005 that I discovered your blog at the time, one of your first blogs, Library Crunch. And I discovered your use of the term Library 2.0, and that started us chit-chatting.
Yes, it was. And I remember, I think the first time I ever heard from you is shortly after here at our library, we had an event called Rock the Shelves.
You're
and
right.
And I posted a bunch of photos of that event up on our Flickr account, or on my Flickr account, rather, because we didn't have one for the library at the time. And that caught your attention, and I believe we emailed a couple of times about it, and you, I think, reshared a photo or two on Tame the Web, if I remember correctly.
Right, and I used one of your photos, beautiful black and white photo, in many, many presentations at that time.
Thank you. Yeah, it was It was a dark environment, and it was in early days of digital, and everything was high ISO, and so it all looked better in black and white.
It was beautiful.
I think we first met in person at Computers and Libraries, if I remember right.
Yep. And then the first thing that we ever did together was August 2006.
Yep, later
when Helen Blowers launched Learning 2.0 at the Public Library of Charlotte-Mecklenburg County.
Yeah, that was exciting too. Those were exciting times.
That was a big deal.
It was. That was the kickoff of what would become a huge program for her.
Right, right. And a global phenomenon.
Yep.
In libraries and beyond now, really.
Yeah, well, and it still continues to this day.
Right, yeah. And that's a really good point to make, just that it has evolved, it has grown. We had 23 things for professional development, and now mobile 23 things, which I've been doing a little research around the original program. So it's really exciting. And how many years has it been? Seven? To see something have that, to be that ongoing and that strong, that really makes me happy.
Yeah, she's done great things with it.
And shout out to Helen.
Yep.
Absolutely. And all the folks that jumped on that and have offered it at their libraries and then made that a way that learning continues. And I think that's the best way to implement that program.
Yep.
Yeah, the program itself is kind of lived on better than Charlotte's had their own misfortunes, but the program has lived on. So.
Yes.
Right. It's very true.
Yeah, Charlotte's been through some difficult times, but they seem to be doing better now, so that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
It's nice when libraries can weather the storm and come out strong from the other side. So. The next thing I wanted to talk about was sort of the origins of not only Tame the Web, but Michael. See, we've got two Michaels here, so Michael Casey, your online work as well. But I wanted to concentrate on Tame the Web first because I don't even know if Michael Stevens, you know this or not, but this podcast actually comes out of Tame the Web in a circuitous way.
Really?
In that my first, the first thing I really did online after, I mean, Facebook, Twitter, all that kind of stuff I was doing, was the first thing I did. I wrote an essay for Leah White for her project that she was doing on Tame the Web, the Young Librarian series.
Yeah.
And then I kind of, out of that, spun the idea of wanting to do this in the first place. And so it kind of goes back to you in a way.
Nice. Well, I appreciate that. And that's nice to hear. Wow. Nice. The origins of Tame the Web. And I've written a bit about this. And we actually celebrated 10 years this past April. It was April 1st, 2003, that I had a brand new Apple laptop sitting at Panera Bread very early in the morning, and I launched a blog. how did the name come around? Very interesting. Before that, before blogging, and this goes back into the 90s, I was doing technology training in the public library, and I was doing extra trainings for nearby public libraries where I lived at the time in Indiana. So to give like a place for people to go to find out what kind of classes I could do, like searching the internet and understanding the internet and all of those things, I put up a little website with my internet provider at the time. And this was probably 96, maybe 97. And I decided to call it Tame the Web because that was at that time, that was when we were trying to figure out how librarians and libraries would fit into the landscape of the burgeoning web. And the name kind of came along with me. And I think it still fits. I think it's always going to be Tame the Web.
And has its mission or vision changed for you over the years, or is it still kind of what you were thinking of when you first started?
What a great question. First and foremost, I always said this, first and foremost, it is always my own personal information manager. If I put something on my blog, somehow it always stayed in my mind that I knew that I could find it there. Over the last few years, and if you look at just how the blog has been, as I have gotten more involved in my teaching and scholarship, I have not sat down and written a huge, gigantic, you know, 10 things that irk me about libraries today type post in years, just because I haven't had the time. So I would say I think the mission has changed a little bit. It kind of changes along with my focus. But what's interesting is I think my focus has always been on a sort of understanding how things work and learning and training and teaching. So I think it's still sort of that vibe underneath, it continues.
Well, if I could just say one thing here. First of all, I too want to point out that, you know, Michael, your blog was the first blog in the library world that I ever was reading. And it was always very influential to me also. What I love about what you've done.
Thanks.
Is you've taken this blog, which has always been very informative and helpful, from a single voice to many voices. And even though by your own admission, you know, you're busier now, you're doing more things, you're spread thinner, this is not like so many blogs that we've seen, including my own. It's not something which has slowed down. In fact, it's probably gotten richer because of the content that is now being created by the people that you're working with and bringing in to populate it. So it's gone from a voice of one to really something more along the lines of a magazine or a newspaper, and you're presenting a lot of information from different vantages and different people, and it's more relevant today perhaps than it ever has been.
Oh, thanks for saying that, Michael. I want to quote Jessamine West here. This is important. Jessamine said to me many years ago, we were talking about blogs being popular. Tame the Web has just consistently seemed to have a lot of reach. And she said, Michael, use your blog powers for good. And I've always done that. You will never see advertisements. I sometimes will say, oh, I really like this. Please consider looking at it. But you will never see an advertisement. I will never ask for money. And I will never like have a sponsor across the top of my blog. But for using the powers for good, to me, that is pulling in the voices that speak to me. And those are I have contributors who are sort of ongoing. I have Tame the Web guest posts. Like if I meet somebody at a conference and their stuff just knocks me out, sometimes I hand them my card and say, please contact me. I will publish a guest post on Tame the Web. I would love it, love it, love it. And then a new thing I've been doing since I got to San Jose, I think just because San Jose is so supportive and encouraging in the online environment, I have been asking students if I can reprint some of their student blogging. And that's a relatively new thing the last couple of years, but that has also... I think that's been very useful, and it also gets their voices out there as they are still in their program. And I think that's another way that we can do good.
Yeah, I think listeners to the podcast, I think, know that I am a fan of yours, because if you look at the contributors on your site, most of them have already been on previously. Leah's been on a few times. Justin's been on. Troy Swanson's been on. So I'm a big fan of what you do.
They're great folks. And if you there's a couple of those contributors that actually have full access to, they can publish. They can, and, you know, I don't even have to be told about it. There's that much trust. So.
That's great. And I love what you're doing with the students. I mean, there's nothing that's more, you know, of a morale boost for a young student or a new student in library science to write something. And then, you know, you tap them and say, can we publish this? And then they see their work on the most popular library blog out there. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, it is. And that's a pretty cool thing.
Well, that ties into something I wanted to talk about anyway, which is... there's sort of a gap that's between getting our MLS when we're educated there and then as a working professional, which, and I think we can tie this into your MOOC a little bit, that there's great opportunities out there for continuing education, but everything is kind of scattered and kind of unfocused because we don't have, like in law and medicine, I mean, there's continuing education that they have to get specifically. They know what they have to do to go forward, whereas we're kind of much more, you know, the state will say you have to have 10 hours, but you can do kind of whatever you want. Do you think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that kind of continuing education? And do you think things like your blog and your MOOC can help with that?
Well, absolutely. And this comes back to what I call professional development with teeth. That, yes, there should be these great opportunities. And I think reading blogs can be a really good one. Personal learning networks, you know, surrounding yourself with all this great stuff. The MOOC, of course, which we can certainly talk about. But it needs to come back to library administration. That instead of just say, oh, yeah, it's staff institute one day a year and the learning is over until we do this again, or we did 23 things and that's done and now we're going on and everything goes back to the way that it was. I think we need to formalize, and this is something that I called for in a column that I wrote called Learning to Learn. We have to formalize these things. And Steve, just like you said, that doctors and lawyers, they have to continue their professional development. They can't not. And I think we should be doing the same thing, that it should go into performance evaluations. If you did take the Hyperlink Library MOOC, you should be able to take that to your supervisor and, you know, like that be a big deal. If you get the certificate, that should count for something because that shows that you applied yourself and you did it. And I think one of the examples I used is doing air quotes, everybody, doing your professional reading at the desk from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. in the afternoon. That to me is not learning.
I would say here too, I think, you know, I was very lucky in that I was able to participate to some degree in this MOOC that Michael Stevens and San Jose had. And it was absolutely fascinating to watch because, you know, I all due respect to, you know, trainers who, you know, we purchase these wonderful learning management systems and they're chock full of a lot of very good courses. But it's kind of like sometimes walking into a Target or a Walmart, and there's just a lot in front of you, and there's no direction necessarily to it. The beauty about the MOOC as a learning tool is that, you know, you have directed readings, but there is a social environment involved. So you have other people taking the courses and being able to communicate with them and talk with them and run ideas by them and read about their ideas and their individual blog posts is such a richer environment. I mean, I'm fortunate. I've got a master's degree, which I earned on-site in the old-fashioned way, and I have a master's in library science, which I earned remotely. And when I did my remote master's, we had nothing like the tools that are now in this MOOC and that we see around us in other, you know, online learning environments. And doing this MOOC with San Jose this fall was so reminiscent of earning a degree on site, on campus, because you had all these opportunities to interact and socialize and talk with and share ideas with your fellow students and your professors that you oftentimes don't have in other learning opportunities. And especially when you just log on to something and you watch a video or you read something and you take a little test after it, professional development is so important to tie that in with the social side of learning. And not just reading something, like Michael said, for, you know, 1 to 3 o'clock for your professional development. So I just want to point it out, because that part of the MOOC environment as a learning opportunity was superb.
And let me give a shout out real quick to Kyle Jones, who is my co-instructor at the Hyperlink Library MOOC. He designed the site architecture that made it so social and so participatory. And a huge shout out to the administration of the School of Library and Information Science at San Jose State for getting behind us and giving us a beautiful giant server that worked well, and providing time and resources for us to do what we did. And the absolutely wonderful students who served as participatory learning guides and homeroom leaders. We had homerooms in the MOOC, who really made all of this come together. And finally, all the guest speakers who came in, and Michael was one of them, and gave of their time for us.
Well, with your MOOC, I thought it was really interesting, because there were the two big sort of library MOOCs this year, yours and David Lankus's. And what was kind of interesting in the difference was Lankus's was a little more focused on sort of, this is library school education, and yours seemed focused more on continuing education. You know, it's like his was bringing the coursework online, and yours was more about bringing people who are already out in the field back in for continuing education. I don't know if you intended it to be that way, or if that's just the way I'm seeing it, but that's how it kind of felt to me. But they were both valid in their own way, but they were kind of from different directions.
Right. We were very much a C MOOC, which is the connectivist or collaborator. It's one of those good C words, where there's much more participation. I think the other one might have been more of an X MOOC, which is more a lot of people, a lot of folks, and they're reading and viewing. We did go into the Hyperlink Library MOOC knowing it would be a professional development opportunity, but the content ported over, like the original foundational content, is exactly what I teach in a class at San Jose called the Hyperlinked Library. So it also was sort of like taking a class, a 4-credit class.
And how many participants did you end up having?
I know those numbers. I can share those with you. We had 1,300 and some folks express interest. Because it was a pilot, because we wanted to test the WordPress system, we capped at 400. We capped at 300. No, we aimed for 400. We sent, I think, 600 emails inviting people to register. And we had 363 people register with the site and set up their user account.
Do you feel like it went well?
I do. And I can speak a little bit to this because I've seen the post-MOOC survey data. I can say a few things. And I actually talked with Library Journal about this for an article that just went up on their website called Opening Up, Next Steps for MOOCs. Out of the 363, of course, we had people that we called inactive. Maybe after the first week, things changed. They didn't have time. So we might half that. Maybe 175 folks or so kept going. And maybe, you know, toward the last bit, and it was long. It was 12 weeks. We might have maybe 100 people that were active, seriously active throughout the time. But looking at the survey data, our first question was, do you feel you were successful in this MOOC? Because that to me is really what it comes down to. And we had three categories. Yes, I was successful. I was somewhat successful. And finally, no, I was not successful. And overwhelmingly, I think 2/3 of the people that took the survey, and I think it's a little under 200 people, they said that they were successful or somewhat successful. So, and this goes back to research I've done on Learning 2.0, which we sort of started this recording with. One of the things we found in the research I did in Australia, and even to some degree when I did some pilot research here in the United States, incompletion does not imply failure. because folks report, and I even see it in the data that we have coming out of the MOOC, that, oh, yes, I got exactly what I wanted out of it. I did a lot of reading. I watched some great videos. I just chose not to blog, or I just chose not to do the assignments. So I would say yes. From my point of view, very successful. And from the point of view of the folks that did that post-MOOC survey, I think we're going to see a high rate of success. And we also asked them, please define what you mean by success. So we have this huge amount of qualitative data to analyze, which is going to be exciting.
And Michael, Casey, can you talk about participating in that, of how you... How did you get? Did Michael just come to you and ask you, or did you ask to be involved? I mean, how did that work, and how did that experience work? Do you think from your end, and how do you think it was received?
I'm honestly blanking on how I was asked, so I will let Michael Stevens answer that.
Well, but... Michael, it's because you've always talked to my classes. That's one reason.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's true. In fact, I think maybe when you first asked me, I just thought this was a regular class. No, I am very lucky in that Michael regularly gives me an opportunity to talk to his ILS students and or MLS students. Sorry, I've got an ILS on the brain. We're doing a migration. And that is always so personally encouraging for me. I mean, Steve, you know, you work in a public library, you know, you got the day-to-day grind, and, you know, just from doing these interviews for you, I'm sure this is very refreshing, and being able to talk to people in other parts of the profession, and I feel the same way when I get to talk to these MLS students. What I took away from the MOOC, a little selfishly, was that this is something, this is a type of structured social learning that we could bring back to a medium or large size public library and do it internally. I remember I think on the first, because I think we did two videos for this MOOC. The first video, when we were trying to set it up, we couldn't get it working. I'm not sure what was going on. And we just decided to jump over and do a Google Hangout. And we got the video on the YouTube, I think. And in fact, I think we even had a couple of people join us live that we didn't know about. I think maybe Kyle or somebody. Mm-hmm. Michael, you know better than I. And at the time, you know, my organization here at this library, you know, we were also just, you know, we were beginning to realize the worth of these Google Hangouts on air. And seeing how Michael Stevens and San Jose used this open source WordPress platform and used, you know, we used the Hangout tool for our videos. All of these tools are available to everybody out there. And if you've got a library that perhaps passes a certain size threshold, I want to be able to use this internally for us to have a structured, socially interactive learning environment that we can begin using to train our staff on new things and keep them up to date on their professional development and create a more exciting learning environment than perhaps we've been able to have in the past. So from a very selfish standpoint, that's what I took away from this MOOC. Now, I will say I'm thoroughly encouraged to hopefully participate in some future MOOCs, not only, you know, maybe talking, but even as a student, because to see what these students were writing in their blogs and the reports that they were putting up online and their, you know, the director's briefs that they were writing and several other things was absolutely fascinating. It was a very different experience than I had in library school. It looked a lot more fun than I can remember it being. So I'd like to do it again from the other vantage, from the student's position.
And would you, Michael Stevens, plan to do it again? I know it's we're recording this basically right after you finished, but
right.
do you have plans for the future to do it again, or do you have any other next steps in mind?
We're going to look at all of our data, and we're going to see what could be improved, what could be changed. We did all those classic questions, you know, what was the cool thing in the MOOC, what didn't work out so well. And I hope that in the future we will offer the MOOC again. I would be very excited to do that. The core group of active folks in the Hyperlink Library MOOC sort of all picked up and moved over and made a Facebook group for themselves, as well as they established their own blog. So it's kind of taken on a life of its own as my part finished. So it's fascinating to watch. So they're calling it the Hyperlink Library MOOC alumni, you know, like the association or whatever. So it's so exciting to me. It's just so heartening to, wow, But yes, I hope to offer, I hope that we will offer it in the future again.
May I ask a quick question here?
Sure.
Michael, I'm curious, you know, just given all that we've seen about, you know, MOOC software and trials and tribulations of that across the country and different attempts to make it work, how happy were you with using WordPress for your MOOC, and would you use it again?
I was very happy with using WordPress. I think I know it would scale up. I know you could have more bodies in the MOOC. We could have 1,000 people all blogging in this WordPress install, whatever. What I'm concerned about, and one of the things I experienced, is I guess I set myself up early on that I felt I should read every single post and make a comment on every single post. And that just, I could not keep up that pace.
Yeah.
That said, I don't know if anybody could keep up with 1,000, if everybody was active with 1,000 librarians blogging. I think we would have to have multiple instructors or limit it. And I kind of get the idea that maybe limiting it would be okay. Maybe 200 people or so, 300 people, somewhere around there. And that, I think that would be a good way to do it with that platform. And I don't think I would use any, I would have to really be sold on another platform, because I would not go to something that, for example, is behind a firewall or behind a password where nobody else can see it. We had, and I'm sorry I'm jumping around a little bit, we had authors. We had David Weinberger, who really inspired the whole concept of my thinking about the hyperlink library, as well as so many other great thinkers back at that time. We had Weinberger actually tweet about the MOOC, and actually I believe he left a comment. I think I have a screenshot of that somewhere on a student's blog. That is a huge, huge deal, because we chose to make it open as possible. I think that's one of the benefits, and WordPress enabled that.
Well, that leads right into what I wanted to talk about next, participatory library service, particularly in the way that Michael Stevens, how you kind of define the hyperlinked library, and Michael Casey, how you defined Library 2.0. Can you talk about that a little bit, of how you kind of came to those individual concepts and how you kind of see that as a beneficial thing for staff and for our communities?
The hyperlinked library as a title is something I started using in presentations probably around 2007. And to be very honest, and this is probably the first time that I've thrown this out there this way, one of the reasons that I did that, I was very inspired by Weinberger's chapter, The Hyperlinked Organization, in the Cloutrain Manifesto. Please, everybody, go read it. But I also was taking a step away from the Library 2.0 term, because I felt the hyperlinked library was broader. Maybe it didn't have as much that came along with it that Library 2.0 did. I did those presentations. I was very lucky to do the hyperlinked library, the big three-hour version of the talk, in Australia in five different cities in 2008. And then it kind of became a thing. And one of the things that I learned in my doctoral studies is if we do modeling, if we model something, it will help us understand it. It will help us describe a phenomenon. So that I sort of formalized it then. And this is when I was kind of ramping up my scholarship side. And I discovered futures research, which is trend spotting and environmental scanning. And I formalized it. And when I brought the class to San Jose, I'm sorry I'm talking so much. When I brought the class to San Jose, I finally got to call it the Hyperlink Library, because before that, it was called Participatory Service. And I introduced it to the students, and just the way we did in the MOOC, as the Hyperlinked Library model. And we look at various facets of the model. So it's a way just to understand my view of what's happening in libraries, how libraries are changing, very much grounded in Michael's concepts of Library 2.0. We use his book, his and Laura's book, as our text, and we actually use that in the MOOC as well.
You know, participatory service was always an important and probably the biggest component of Library 2.0. And you know, I took the term, and I've said this before in writing and in other interviews, that, you know, it really derived more from what we saw going on in the business 2.0 area than in the web 2.0. The components of what was coming for libraries, it wasn't so much the technology and the tools, because you use them to fulfill your goals and the purposes you set out to achieve. It really was the new model of relationships that organizations, whether that was a commercial or nonprofit or government or whatever type of organization it was, we saw them making new relationships both internally and externally, and driving business based upon those new relationships. And that really formed the basis for participatory service, which was the subtitle of the book, by the way, that I wrote, Library 2.0, subtitled Participatory Service. The idea of reaching into your community more than just to the top-level funding agents and more than just to your friends groups, but using the tools that are available to you, and those tools have only gotten better since we first started writing about this 7-8 years ago, using the tools to reach into your community to find out exactly what was important to those people, what is it that the library can do for them, and what are they looking to the library for, and also participatory leadership on the inside of the library, reaching out to your staff and getting their take on as many things as possible, and incorporating your goals into what staff are doing, are being trained on, being developed for. It really is a very sort of organic thing, so to speak, but it's much more of an operational behavior than it is a technology tool. I don't know if that goes to what you're asking, but
no, that's actually exactly what I was asking, and that's why I wanted to phrase it with talking about participatory service, because I think a lot of the, I almost want to say 100% of the criticism that I've heard of those models has always been, oh, look, they just want libraries to get on Facebook and Twitter, and then we're current, and that's really not what it's about. I mean, those are tools for accomplishing a goal, and that's not the end goal itself.
Steve, the thing that that I do, and students sign up for the class, and the people signed up for the MOOC, and I think they, you know, to some degree, they're thinking, oh, it's going to be a technology class. But guess what? When they get in, it's really about people, and it's about humanism, and it's how we can reach into our communities with all those things that come along with being human.
Yeah, and I think Twitter and Facebook and social media, all that helps do that, but again, it's not the reason for doing it.
Right.
It's not just the, oh, look, something shiny, let's go do it kind of.
Michael, that's why I continue to use your textbook and or your book, and I guess we should shout out to Information Today, because they gave the book for free to everybody that signed up for the Hyperlink Library MOOC. And I did some writing back in the day about the different tools. But the beautiful thing about the Participatory Service book is it's a philosophy of service. It's not a, these are the tools of the day. They may be mentioned, but it's not just, oh, here's how you blog, here's what a wiki is, here's how you use RSS. Because that, you know, that comes and goes so quickly.
It does, and we are very lucky in that the tools have become easier to use. I think, Michael, one of the things you speak to, and I think, you know, we see it in organizations that try to operate in a participatory manner, is that the more of these individual relationships the organization can build with people in the community, the easier it is for that organization to tell its story. And, you know, libraries have numbers. We have a lot of numbers available to us, how many books people check out, how many people come into the library. But as we all know, when you're talking to your community and to your funding agents, some people respond to numbers, other people respond to stories. And the more the more people you can reach, and the easier it is to tell these stories to your community through all the various tools that are available to us now, the better you're really going to be. And you know, I think when we started in 05, I'm not even sure if you could join Facebook if you weren't a student. But the growth of the tools, what we see you doing with the MOOC and the WordPress installation, what we see ourselves here in my own library being able to do in creating small little learning environments in Google Hangouts, and then repurposing that video for later on. We have so many more opportunities as an organization to reach out and touch people in the community across multiple platforms that there's really no excuse for not making that effort.
Yeah, and I think that data is really important to have, but it's sort of, it doesn't tell the right story. What you need to convince your stakeholders is why you're important, and data doesn't tell anything about why. It's just
a component. Yep.
Right. This door count, but why is it important that we have this door count? Why is it important that we circulate this many items? And I think that's really what's key to our futures. You all wrote a column together for Library Journal for a couple of years called The Transparent Library. Can you talk about the general concept of what you think of as the transparent library and why transparency is important sort of within and without, like why it's important within an organization and why it's important to be to the outside world as well?
I think a lot of it stems from what we just spoke about, which is a participatory library. You can't be in the community as much as we need to be if you're closed off, if you're walled. One of the fundamental tenets that we saw developing over the last decade in the business, you know, world and government is transparency. And transparency breeds trust. Transparency allows you to communicate and talk to your community in a manner which you perhaps weren't able to in the past. Transparency on the inside of an organization breeds better morale and trust, top to bottom, administrators to frontline staff. And I think if you look back at the columns that we wrote, so many of them deal with, in one fashion or another, relationships in an organization from the top to the bottom and the bottom to the top. So, Michael, I'll let you fill in there, but that's kind of how I see it.
Well, absolutely. And what I realized, I think maybe halfway through those 2 years we got to write, was so much of it was aimed at administrators. I think we were even subconsciously writing, hopefully, for the library directors, the library deans, all those folks that might read it and be inspired. And I know occasionally we aim things at, you know, dear frontline staff and right, things like that. But yeah,
I think we even wrote the directors directly in one of the columns.
Yeah, yeah, dear director. What fun was that? I so enjoyed that. And that's why when the book thing broke in Urbana, I got Michael. I said, oh, wow, I wish we were writing The Transparent Library. Will you please give me a quote for office hours? So nice to come back to that.
It was. And hopefully, I think, should we mention what we're working on there?
I think go ahead and mention it. I think it's kind of interesting.
We're splitting the columns into an ebook, and we're going to put in a little other content also from outside just the column itself, a few other things we wrote. And I think we're going to add a new essay or two along the way. And hopefully that'll be out in early 2014.
And yes. Do you guys remember back when you first started it? How did you just start it with getting in the relationship with Library Journal? But how did you decide that was going to be your, like, you decided, okay, we're going to write a column together. How did you decide that's going to be our topic?
I seem to remember Library Journal reaching out to us and asking if we would write a. Am I wrong there, Michael?
I think we were approached. I think we were approached by a couple of the big library magazines, shall we say, and we went with Library Journal.
Yeah, that's right. There was a little bit of a, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of back and forth, a little bit, that's fine.
One was a little more open at the time than the other.
And they came to you with the idea already of, like, that this is what they wanted from you? Or did they just say, we want Michael and Michael,
your thoughts? That's really, I think, what they said. They wanted all the stuff that we had been doing on Library Crunch and Tame the Web.
Yep. Yeah, because we went back and forth on what the column that was not set before before we started writing. You know, the great thing was we weren't the only two by any stretch. There were others talking about these things also, but you know, we were definitely talking about some similar things in the world of librarianship and libraries. And I think the voices complemented each other in that regard, and I think that made it a successful almost 3-year run.
Absolutely.
Well, something you guys talked about in the guest lecture that Michael Casey, you did for the MOOC, was something that I've been interested in the past as well. And I wrote an essay for another site about it, is failure as a learning tool. And I wonder if you could talk about that as a concept, because I think that's really important to accept that you're going to fail and not just wallow sort of in your failure, but to learn from that and move forward.
Well, I'll just say one thing, and then I'll let Michael Stevens talk on that. Going back to one of the earlier things that I ever spoke about, and we put it in the book, was this process of constantly reviewing things. In fact, we even had a model for putting teams in place that would include a review team to take a look back at what was created, and ask the very fundamental question is what's working and what's not working. And that really is tied into being accepting of failure and recognizing that, you know, everything we do doesn't have to be a zero-sum equation. If your library puts a service in place, if it isn't meeting whatever metrics you laid out as defining success, and hopefully in the earlier parts of the process you did define some metrics that you could measure against later on, you don't have to kill the service. You just have to accept that it wasn't set up in the right way to begin with, and then restructure it. Failure, we meet failure almost every day. It cannot stand in the way of moving forward and making change and becoming successful in what we're doing. We have to get comfortable, and I think, you know, Steve, you're a parent. I'm a parent. Teaching kids to be okay with failing in something is one of the most important things we have to do. And if you let failure stop your progress, if you see failure as an absolute, you know, deal breaker, you're not going to get very far.
Absolutely. And Michael, you said that very well. I wouldn't have much more to add, but learning from mistakes. And we had Justin from Chattanooga and my colleague Warren from Australia do a Google Hangout for the MOOC on the same topic about how they were learning from when things didn't go the right way.
Yeah, and Justin did a post for Tame the Web about when he broke the 3D printer, quote unquote.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty good picture. Given the economy we were just in, I think we are in the middle of seeing a lot of case studies on libraries dealing with setbacks, reorganizing, redefining what they want to do and how they define success and moving forward again. So in the not too distant future, we're going to have a lot of interesting case studies to examine regarding what was, you know, what failure was and how people responded to setbacks.
Right.
And Michael, you mentioned, I think it was the weeding crisis up in Urbana, which will be another case study to look at in time.
Absolutely.
Well, I wanted to talk about one more thing that's sort of related to 3D printing, I guess, now that I've brought that up. I believe, Michael Stevens, you wrote about this sometime recently, or it was in something that I read when I was researching this. It's sort of striking a balance between techno lust for emerging tech, but then also what's practical. So you don't just get a 3D printer because it's a 3D printer and, hey, I got a 3D printer. You have sort of an idea in mind of what you'd like to do with this, or you have sort of some structural underpinnings for that. You're not just getting it because it's nice and shiny. And balancing that with the fact that, like with the new Pew results that came out, that people still, you know, 80% think that we're about books and reading.
Right.
That's important to remember and to keep in mind, that you don't just say, well, forget you people, because that's not what libraries do anymore. We are that, but we're also these new things, and we have to look for ways to overlap and embrace new technology without making the other people feel like they're not included anymore either.
Absolutely. It is a huge balancing act. And I think one of the things that, when there was pushback about all of these discussions we were having about blogs in 2006, about Facebook in 2009 or whatever, was people jumped to the conclusion that the speakers, the writers were implying that means we're getting rid of the books, or we're getting rid of the story time, or we're getting rid of all the things that we've done. But I don't think it was ever that way. It was just finding new channels to reach out to folks. And as I said in that column that you mentioned, I think I have been I was very vocal about saying, well, it's not the collection. It's not the collection. It's people. It's getting people. It's community and all those things. But it is also the collection. And having that balance is going to be important, as long as there are printed books and as long as there are things that we can purchase and collect and put in our buildings. Absolutely. We have to take care of them.
The last subject I wanted to talk about was sort of relating then back to education, in that a lot of our continuing education comes from mentoring, and especially earlier in our career when we're sort of learning how to be librarians, we try to find people to latch on to and learn from, though I think that kind of continues on in our careers. It's nice to always have somebody to look up to and try to emulate. But I talked to Leah White about this, and she helped me sort of frame this question of, how do you transition then, once you feel you're confident in your field, how do you transition from being a mentee to being a mentor?
Wow. That's a great question.
Because I know Leah especially was feeling that, because she mentioned you specifically as somebody she felt as a mentor, but now she's feeling that she's kind of been in the profession, you know, for a few years, and now she's looking to take opportunities to be a mentor herself. And so it's sort of that it's a kind of an odd transitionary period.
And you know, that's true, because her work is there, and we see what she has done, and there's good stuff. She's done some great things, and that's a really interesting thing. And I think what came to my mind about it is, there, once you do become the mentor, there's some responsibility that comes with that. That if people do seek you out and people do ask you questions, that you might want to devote some time to, you know, people that maybe resonate, their work resonates with you or whatever. But it is a serious thing. And if you become kind of a big deal in our tiny, tiny little world, I think it is imperative that you set a good example. And if you think about it, it comes back to professional development with teeth. Maybe mentoring, can we formalize it in some way? Can it be part of the process as a librarian that you are a mentee for a certain number of years or as long as you think you need it? And then maybe it is expected as part of your service to the profession. And I think we really should be serious about service to the profession, that you should mentor. And it might take different, it might be virtual mentoring, it might be mentoring in your workplace, in the library you work in, or the information environment or whatever. But maybe more formalization would be a really interesting thing to explore.
Looking at it locally, maybe we don't remember this enough, and by we, I mean, you know, if you're in administration or if you're a chair of a team or something like that. When you're at the table with, you know, with a team or with your staff, I do think you should keep in mind, and I fail at this sometimes. I think I don't remind myself of it enough, that you really are, you know, you're modeling behavior, and you're modeling a leadership style, and you're modeling professionalism to those people. And while it's not a formal mentor-mentee relationship, it is a type of relationship where you do need to keep in mind and realize that how you you know, model yourself or display yourself, and how you act is seen by others, and then oftentimes, you know, that they'll learn from that, whether it's, you know, direct or indirectly, that that is how such a team chair or a leader or administrator behaves. So even on the local level, I do think we need to constantly remind ourselves that we're setting examples to others, and we need to act accordingly. You know, when your organization goes through difficult times, you don't want to sit at the head of that table and pretend as if nothing's wrong. You want them to have a realistic framework, a realistic idea of what's going on. So it's balancing, you know, how much do you share? You don't want your team, just like you don't want your kids to think that everything is fine and dandy and you know, when in fact the emperor's got no clothes. But it's very difficult sometimes to lead or to set examples in those more difficult and trying times. But you do have to keep it in mind.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
No, thank you. This was cool. Fun. It was fun.
Cool.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.
Can I invoke the, could you cut that last bit out?
Yes, we can do that.
We should really try to get some swearing in.
Get it in now. We're getting it in now while we're editing out. So.